Interesting emails. I want to actually touch on that whole notion of the change in the approach and attitude, because it's something I'm picking up a
lot.
To me, that is
key. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I put to Caswell Franklin last mm-hmm. week, because he was making the point that two senior people said, these people doing all this thing, but, you know, this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Their attitude. And you see, the whole thing about it is, and I talk about this in workflow analysis, because it's important. And I worked in the public sector for at least 2 years, but 2 years and some. And so I know what I'm talking about based on what I saw there and, of course, my interaction. But the whole thing about it is, you cannot expect that as technology has moved on, that we will continue doing things in the same way. But I want to move off of that, because I think we've kind of exhausted that. The key thing to me is looking at the last in, first out principle, because this is one of the things that people have been talking about all the time. And, you know, the only reason that you're going to have this last in, first out system is because you don't have an effective appraisal system in, you know, where you actually look at people's performance, look, you know, and appraise them on different criteria. This is what is needed, because clearly this system is not the best system. But here again, the unions, as well as the public servants, as well as government, whichever government is in power, are to blame for this, because, you know, it's like a vested interest as far as I'm concerned. And here I'm going to deal with the person who actually sent that new WhatsApp saying that, you know, we're just pulling down public servants. No, public servants are a necessity. The public servants that I worked with in the old days at the Barbados Water Authority were some of the most efficient people who worked really, really hard. Some of them are still there today, 30 plus years later. They're still there. They're about to go home, but they have always worked hard. They have always been conscientious. I know public servants right through the system who are extremely conscientious. But, you know, you have to call a spade a spade. The fact about the matter is that there is a level of inefficiency that has to be dealt with. And now, having dealt with him, let me just get back to this whole thing about this appraisal system. In the private sector, you set that appraisal system up, you have those discussions with the union if the place is unionized, and you look at the different criteria and the different measurements you have to put in place and whatnot. And this is done. This is in the interest of the employee and the employer. True. Why has it taken so long, despite we having the public sector reform, and Glenn will know a lot about private sector reform, despite all of that, why has it taken it so long? It is not in the union's interest to push it. And then some unions I would expect to call in at some time. But really and truly, if you think about it, it is really not in the union's interest to push that.
I don't know if I can just get a quick opportunity to respond.
A quick warning, because we have the...
Let me give it away then.
We got NUPW, Wayne Waldron on the line.
Yes, come here, Wayne, so. Please.
Yes, good morning, Wayne Waldron, Assistant General Secretary.
Hi, Wayne, how are you doing?
Good morning. Yeah, so hearing the debate, some passion with the public sector, some interesting discussions about the reform. But let me say first about reform. Reform should be a continuous process. Now, you go back to 1991, you go back to other structural adjustment. If you are reforming a public sector, it must be continuous. It cannot be a knee-jerk reaction to crunch numbers when you're in a crisis to see after downsize deeper deficits. I'm afraid that what we are seeing is a knee-jerk reaction always. This comes up, modernization, restructuring, the debate with oversized public sector inefficiencies, not being productive, looking at processes, fine. But this restructuring, if you want to really restructure the public service, you've got to look at one, political interference. You've got to look at relevant legislation. You've got to look at the whole ambit of things. For example, the ease of doing business, the arcade legislation, that is too bureaucratic. So I may be bashing public servants.
We're saying
you is not.
Wayne, stop. Wayne, forgive me for interfering you here, Wayne. But when nobody here is bashing public servants, so please disavow yourself of that. We're not bashing public servants.
The whole thing we have been involved as public sector reform.
I'd like to say something.
Right,
next, please.
Okay, no problem.
The end policy.
Yes, Glenn, I heard you.
After that.
Yes, please.
The whole question of evaluation, that is a very important part I'd like to deal with. Still talking?
But we ain't with talking.
Mm. Let's go on, please.
Yeah. All right, but the reason for state-owned enterprises was not necessarily profit. The ones that generate revenue, but they're very nature like water authority. The ones that collect revenue are supposed to be efficient. It's possible to collect revenue. The reason for state-owned enterprises was to cut out the somebody right there and increase efficiency.
True.
Take it out of the central government, make it a board that can make quick decisions that could invest. And as I said, to be more efficient, that was the thing with state-owned enterprises. State-owned enterprises is still a creature of the government. I hear the being bashed. I think the problem, if you're looking at state-owned enterprises, how they evolve, how they restructure. But I hear some bashing about transfers. Now, who create these state-owned enterprises? They were created for a reason. And as I said, to cut out a lot of the bureaucratic red tape that you'll find in the general service, where a board, you have a board, you have a chairman, and you can make decisions quickly. You operate under an act called, wherever the act is, NCC Act, whatever, BADMC Act, there's an act for every board.
Right.
Right? So if those were to cut out the red tape and increase efficiency, the debate could be what are the areas of concern in terms of efficiency? But those at water authority, yes. If they are revenue collection, they are supposed to be efficient as possible in their revenue collection. That's one. The last thing for us, so there's a debate on this here. Now, I will tell you why the last thing for us so is a greeter. Now, even at civil service level, now if you go for the performance appraisal, as you said, that's absent. But let's look at the complications, the reality. You move in, say, for example, MTW. You want 200 persons. So you're saying you're going to take out the least 200 persons that are not performing. It means you have to put all the fuzz. You have to do a pecking order. In terms of due process, no, you can't wait till after 10, 15 years to say Vin Warren's a bad worker. You didn't do any reports. There's no indication. There has to be a matrix on the whole of MTW to determine the pecking order so that you don't get litigation with people challenging with lack of due process and so forth. So that's a complicated thing. Now, if you're going to go appraisal, you have to got all the data there in the spreadsheet. You have to have the entire staff for that department so that when you do your pecking order and there's some rating scheme, it could start to scrutiny, right?
Agreed,
But the import relief for, you see, and government, when there's a retrenchment, it's a quick exercise. And they don't know if they have the luxury or anything to, even if they had all the matrix there with the information to go through that, challenge it, somebody said, well, that's not so. I never saw my letter. You never warned me. I'm not aware. There's a lot of logistics with appraisals that could give rise to a lot of problems and grievances. So even though LIFO is not the perfect system, yes, it's possible that you could get some of the best performers being affected by it. But for expediency in these type of large retrenchment exercise, the civil service and the government even find it more convenient for the LIFO also. So that is why, so we understand the debate about, for example, the LIFO may affect young persons, being retrenched, because these are the persons now who you may argue you need. The LIFO may affect some of the good performers. It's possible. But as we agree around the table, that civil service is not perfect, but to me it's the most equitable way to deal with the fast track or a retrenchment exercise. So yes, We understand the debate about the is nonsense. You should be dealing with performance, maybe union encouraging nonsense and not really interested in performance. But we are interested in performance because I need to tell everybody we put on productivity seminars on productivity. We also, when we go and outreach programs, we talk about ethics, rights and responsibility, the worker and the employer. There are things we do, but they don't go public. And because it don't go up, but it's assumed that we're not interested in these things.
Glenn, I want to cut in here now. Glenn, with your permission, I want to ask a quick question because it's specifically on what he's talking about now.
I need to talk about the system.
Right, okay. So, Wayne, just this quick question. On the ground, I'm hearing there's a contradiction between the LIFO and the actual that simultaneously you are modernizing the service. And people are saying, okay, you're sending home the younger persons and modernizing the service at the same time, where it may be agreed that the younger persons may be more conducive to, or maybe a more conducive environment to having them there in terms of modernizing the service. How do you treat to that?
Well, it's an argument that we get into debate. As I alluded to the fact that LIFO is not perfect, but that's another debate. If you're truly talking about modernizing, it would mean that if the restriction was an ongoing process, And if you're talking about right-sized public sector and whatever, if you don't want these things over 2 decades, you will get it right. But you see, unfortunately, when you got these knee-jerk reactions to crunch numbers to meet your IMF conditionality, in fact, this exercise is so wild. You have to go and do some recall. Okay, we chop here, we chop there, because you're looking at a spreadsheet of posts. You say you probably will say, but I want 300 from MTW. But it's no real thought of how it will cripple operations and so forth. But I think this exercise, truthfully speaking, as much as we talk about modernization going digital, they have to come up with numbers to match targets.
But when
understand the BERT program.
Right. When let me ask a question as well. What facility is there for government to dismiss a public server who has worked for 20 years in a post that is obsolete? Is there a capacity for government and is appointed?
Yes, there's an abolition of posts. It's a process. The abolition on the cap 24.
How costly is it?
You abolish the post, you go to parliament, you abolish the post.
You go to parliament and abolish the post. Mm-hmm. How costly is it for you to send home that public servant?
Well, what you do, if you abolish the post, the most junior one, let me give you an example.
No, but I'm just trying to move the conversation quickly along because I want you to make the point that it's all right to talk about sending home what you would say are some of the more obsolete public servants. But once a public servant's passed 10 years, and if the person is appointed, as far as I know, it is almost impossible to remove them, and the cost associated with it, if you can do it, would make a nonsense of this whole IMF exercise.
But Peter, one of the things there, though, is understanding that. Let me point this point to Peter.
Don't forget me.
I ain't forgetting you at all. Peter, the argument here is that this process is for the medium to long term. I think that we run away from doing that in the short term.
But in the medium to long term,
I think that those decisions still have to be made, albeit with full analysis.
But can it be done, Wayne? Can it be done at a cost that is reasonable?
It has been done for the transition of workers to QEH. It has been done for the airport. You abolish the post. But what you do in the process is to give the person the option to have a comparable position. If they refuse it, then you pension them off immediately, right? And then that's what should happen. You should pension them off immediately. So, yes, we can abolish posts. There was discussion recently about abolishing posts.
In customs.
But coming to the obsolete thing, the standard typist, though, even though the title in itself, but it's very name, but it's very title is obsolete. These workers are doing relevant jobs. For example, a lot of standard typists are doing clerical officer functions. They're multitasking. They do accounting. Heard at least that she prepared cabinet papers. They do a myriad of things within the clerical grade or the secretarial. So even though somebody came in and looked at the whole matrix and said, look, these jobs are obsolete. Okay, but the very title, we can agree with that. But what they didn't examine the actual functioning of these jobs. These persons are not really standard types, but actual functioning. So what they should really do? Regrade the job and reassign the persons or just change the title to clerk officer or some relevant title.
And that goes back, Wayne, to the point that you made from the very beginning, which I agree with you totally with, is that it's a whole continuing process of when you're talking about restructuring. It's a continuing process as against knee-jerk. And that is, in my view, the key thing in all of this. We have got to look at our... We have got to, in terms of dealing with the system now... All right, well, go ahead, Glenn.
Come in, Glenn. Come right in.
I think Wayne is making a very important... The civil service, like any bureaucracy, it can be a Byzantine word, a complex, confused word for those who don't understand the intricacies and nuances of it. That is why Casimir Frank is so effective, because he spent a lot of time in it, he's versed in it, and he knows things that other people don't even imagine exist. But the point is, let me deal with the appraisal. As the one who led the last serious effort about public tax reform, I was able to set the Office of Public Tax Reform, which was associated with ongoing process of reform. And an important integral part of that reform was a performance review, PRDS, Performance Review Development System, where each officer would be called in at the beginning of the year, said, these are your benchmarks, these are objectives. Then at June, he'd be called to review it to see if he'd made it. and then the satisfaction with his performance. And then at the end of the year, he's graded in his presence with other people to supervise it. So there's a structured, organized performance system that was being put in place. When it left in 2003, it was up and running. I don't know what happened to it since then. And certainly know that the public sector reform effort was highly supportive with the people at the bottom. Because what we did, we set up an internal review committee in each department, each ministry, who were to generate their own ideas of what would make their department work best, so we can make it efficient, etc. And then that effort was set up to the Office of Public Sector Reform. The resistance came from senior public officers, PSs and whatnot, who felt that any change like that, because they resisted being subject to the same performance review. It was supposed to be 360 appraisal, or even permanent secretaries were supposed to review. They objected to that, and they resisted because it felt we diminished their power and their influence on water. So you had this internal tension, and that is what had to stymie the effort. But certainly from my experience, the day-to-day officers were very keen on it. They came with slogans, they came with themes. They came in, like, for example, it was suggested that one of the first things you could do in reform is to deal with mass places like the post office, like the registry where lots of people are going to get births and death certificates. And there was efforts made to speed up that process, enhance that process. So I'm saying that there was a groundwork for it. It was thought about, it was seen that it would be an ongoing effort. We also have customer charities whereby if you go to customs, you say, we guarantee you that once all your information is in and relevant, you will get back your approved thing in an hour, 2 hours, a day, 3 weeks, or whatever. So there were benchmarks that were being set. So it was a serious, comprehensive effort, but I think it fell off. It fell through.
On the other hand, I have a message here. It says, Glenn, the PRDS was not up and running. I was in the service for 45 years. I left this year, and no one has ever done a PRDS on me. So again, management of these systems sometimes is where we actually fall down. But you've got to take a break now.
There was a lady called Mrs. Turton, I know, who was doing an excellent job. I think she's retired on it. So I know it did exist. I saw forms. I saw a specimen form. It was in the process, but I don't know what happened after I left.
It probably went the way of most things. 8 minutes before noon, this is Brass Tack Sunday in association with Williams Industries Incorporated.
You don't have to be a roofing expert to know that a metal sheet will rust where it is joined. That is one reason why the beautiful Permaclad U-Panel and R-Panel roof sheet sold at Williams Metals will outlast other roofing materials. Permaclad, colorclad, and corrugated sheets are cut to the exact length that you will need, up to 40 feet and even longer. That means no joints from ridge to eave. Colorclad sheets come with a factory painted finish in white, blue, green, red, brown, and yellow, and are fitted with screws for added resistance, tested to withstand high winds up to 130 miles an hour. Get a rail roof supplied at competitive prices, delivered to you today from Williams Metals. Simply call Williams at Kane Garden St. Thomas, 425-2000, or Lowlands Christ Church, 428-1500.
Visit their website at www.williamsmetals.bb.
Okay, we're having the moderators panel looking at austerity and the future. Let's wrap up with Wayne Waldron, and then we take a couple more calls. Wayne, you're still there?
Yes. Mm-hmm. There are a few things that we encounter in this whole retrenchment process. One, we had make a representation that customs be not affected because, and this is in government interest, that the revenue collection section of it, you don't want in the dislocation. Please do not retrench no staff from that department. Customs is a peculiar department where you have a clerical officer doing foot and customs work, fully trained, because there are not enough posts of custom officers. So you have clerical officers actually doing customs work, I would say being underpaid, but are fully trained and uniformed custom officers. So we said, even though you're looking generally at cutting clerical officers, remember in the case of customs, it may be called a special need that you should exempt them. Now, we understand we're getting some backup in customs. They are already short of staff. Now, obviously, it's in government interest to not compromise this revenue. There can't be no IMF conditionality that certainly would ask government to compromise this revenue. So I was puzzled when I understand they cut 18 officers. That is our information. That is one issue.
That would have been a homegrown decision.
Yeah. No, right. The other issue is that the Prime Minister would have said 10 persons with more years of should not go home. But what we have is persons with 12, 13 years, 20 years being terminated. So we are not sure where these stats are coming from. So even though you at the stage where you know there's a retrenchment, you want clear disclosure of what's going on so that you understand that, look, what is the reason for going back to 10, 15, 20 years when you understand that the cut was to be at a certain point? Is it that you can't get the numbers? We don't have the information.
My understanding, and Wayne, you could correct me if I'm wrong, is that on one hand, you're saying you're using LIFO, and then on the other hand, you were completely closing certain departments, like, for instance, drainage and MTW. So there would have been persons in there who would have had 12 and 20 years, some of whom I actually know. So I think that is why you have some, in some cases, you have people 20 years going because their department.
I don't know why, given the pronouncement that 10 or more years should not go on, what's happening here?
They should have been reallocated.
They should be recalled. They should recall all of those letters.
If I might ask a quick
question. Glenn, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, Wayne, are you happy? Are you satisfied with the amount of involvement or advice sort of the unions in general, even the social partnership as a whole question? I get the feeling from listening to the pronouncements from the various workers that they were informed and told rather than discussed and agreed and a consensus or whatever, that it was more that, you know, in government, the party law said that the prime minister shall appoint somebody in consultation with the leading opposition. But in some cases, that consultation means they just call them or write them and say, I intend to...
It's more like you make a decision.
And it's a formality. Has it been a formality or there's been stirred discussion and agreement and consensus and understanding, which is what the social partnership is supposed to be about? It's supposed to be a national...
The social partnership, you touched on an interesting area. No, this program will not work because I hear the private sector talking and healing the whole thing with the work program. But what concerns me, if you're in a social partnership, I want to hear more what the private sector plan to do to diversify the economy and create growth, because we got to take risks. We're talking about this sort of thing where people going to want to be entrepreneurs, but I think the ones that got capital can certainly take some risks and really diversify the economy. This thing we're buying and selling using foreign exchange, we have to change from that. So therefore, I'm saying if you're really a social partnership, I want to see where the capitalists that own the means can come now with a different form and diversify and say what are the areas we can pursue to diverse economy and be more export-oriented. And exactly the discussions we need to have. A social partnership can't be just about chopping labor, because this program will not be effective. That it will reduce is a short-term thing. We're dealing with a deficit in expenditure. But when you are dealing with a long-term program, I need to hear more from the private sector who are giving a take to this program to say the private sector are going to ensure this economy is private sector driven, that we don't enter this problem again with downsizing and right sizing. We need more discussion. So I'm not satisfied that if we're getting that dialogue at that level, it seems to be just labor and chopping labor. I'm not hearing enough. Maybe things are going on, but I don't get the sense that we're hearing enough from the private sector of what they're actually doing to drive this economy, because it needs economic growth in this whole exercise. So that is wrong with the private sector.
This is the same public sector which has over the years been justly criticized for being laid back, too laissez-faire, no initiative, not aggressive. And if we are still, the economic situation is still very tight and rough, this, because capitalists and businessmen are out to make money, they're only going to take risks to which they think will pay off the long. They're not going to do anything for the good of the country, and they'll lose money. I'm not one of these who's bought into this neoliberal thought that government has to be small and tight, and the private sector will do anything. They want to say a perfect market. The markets of the world are not perfect. They're human beings using their prejudices, their objectives, their goals to manipulate things every day. The same thing happens in Barbados.
All right, fair enough. All right, Wayne, I want to thank you very much for coming in at this stage. I'll take two WhatsApps, and then we go back to the panel and the lines. This one says, Corey, I sent a request to a private sector and a public sector agency, both on August 6th this year. By 7:45 a.m. on the 7th, a response was had from the private sector. Within 3 weeks, a response was received with information requested. Today, I am still waiting on the public sector agency to even find out if the email I sent had been received. All questions on the matter are treated without any urgency, even after almost 3 months. Extremely frustrating to conclude business this way. There's another one here I really wanted to read here, and here it is. I can actually use this one to segue into something else I really think we need to talk about. And that is, that was when the DLP was in power. What is she doing now? We have moderators whose job it is to defend everything Mia does. The DLP ain't making no structural adjustment. It's the BLP. You get the vote and now you're assassinating the jobs. One of the things I hear in relation to this austerity program, and guys, you've got to admit that programs like these are very important in terms of getting information out, creating narratives and so on. My disappointment is that too little people read too little. So there are not many people out there reading. So people are telling me about various things that are going on. And the only reason that I know that they may not be speaking total truths is because I took the time to read through the Burks and listen to the press conferences and so on. On the other hand, there are a lot of people that are accusing programs like these and moderators like us of changing the narratives now. So for instance, under the DLP, when there was retrenchment, there was a big hullabaloo. And now there's a lot of support coming from this side. And I think it's something that we should deal with frontally. My thing is that is it a case of not being as objective as we should be or should be, or a case where we're actually seeing that there's more confidence, there's more measures put in place, there's things that are going with the policies that would redound to the benefit of Barbados. And I think it's something that we should deal with, because actually those are two of many, many WhatsApps here speaking about the changing face and the changing role of the media and commentators and what is going on in Barbados. And that's why I'm glad we have this show today. So I see Dennis ready to take the first punch at this.
I don't know why you think I'm taking the first punch at this. Look, the According program is supposed to reflect the views and opinions of the callers. Moderators have their own views and opinions. They differ from time to time with those of the callers. There are times when they don't. There are times when they take a position and hold it because of their own personally held preferences for one or the other. I've sat through several programs. I certainly sat through a lot of the 19, as a matter of fact, I joined the program in the midst of the Sandy Ford meltdown. So I heard a lot of that. As a matter of fact, the reason why was because I called the program to counter something someone was saying about the hospitality industry. That's how I ended up in the chair. But this accusation that moderators are in people's pockets is supported by the fact that when the DLP came into office, we had an exodus of moderators. The BLP has come into office, and people are expecting.
Hearing, but one getting a big what?
The BLP has come into office, and
I know before
there
before
is anticipated to be another exodus of moderators. Now,
of a moderator?
No, moderators.
I think all moderators are still here.
That's hold on. After dropping that, I did that on purpose. So let me say this, okay? If the feeling of those who sit and host the programs, if the feeling is that the country was on the wrong trajectory, then they would say so. Mm-hmm. If they felt that, and I certainly feel that cutting salaries, and I've said so just now, is not going to grow, it's not going to earn us money. And that's one thing I've held firm on through all this. We have to earn. Even leading up during the election campaign, that was my theme. We have to earn our way in the world. If people want to see that one-sided, that's their business. Because I used to get WhatsApp messages telling me that DLP are at foul, and I don't want to criticize the government, and I don't want to cuss ministers because of the line that was taken. So the shoe's on the other foot now. Perception is in the eye of the perceiver. Okay, that's my comment on it. But let me say this, and you made the point. I think what I hear when I listen and I produce, so I sit here and listen to every one of you, what I hear is general support for the fact that we need to change the way we do business. And therefore, there is support for what has to be done. Now, there may be discussions about the way it's being done, what's happening first and what should happen last. And I've listened to all of that from sitting here as the producer. So I know that there's a general perception, certainly from sitting here, that there is support for the fact that something has to be done.
Scurry.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
First of all, I'd like to do with something that Peter raised in his opening statement when he talked about the 1981 Tom Adams venture to the IMF. He certainly does not remember much about it. Or he's probably too young. I'm not sure if he's still too young for that, Peter. Or not.
I wasn't born yet.
You were, see, there you are. You were. In 1981, you know, much hullabaloo has been made that this current program was negotiated within, what, 3 months of the IMF. Tom Adams' own was negotiated 15 minutes. 15 minutes. Because as a trade economist, by the time he went to the IMF, he had already taken the corrective measures, and there was not the dislocation or evil as there was in 92 and now. But that was a different approach. It was a different era because the political and economic leadership of Tom Adams.
Okay, it was less money too, Glenn. Come off it. This is an extended fund facility. We've never had that before. It was a standby arrangement, so it must be easier to negotiate.
But I'm talking about the whole process was, I was there.
Because it's a different initiative, Glenn. It's a different initiative. An extended fund facility is by definition more austere than a standby, right? So if Tom was negotiating a standby facility, you would expect that it would be easier.
But I'm saying it was easy because it took steps to make it easier.
And also because it was a different initiative.
It
was a different program.
Let's move on that. Let's move on. I don't want
to
spend.
But no, but was it or wasn't it? I mean, it's easy to just say it was, right? So let's not make nothing about it.
Wrong with it because they're serving two different purposes. The objectives are said, therefore the methods are different. They're not the same. You don't get the same. You don't get the same treatment for every program.
You don't get the same amount of money neither.
But what money? I mean, $280 million. I thought Barbados could have gotten 440,000 of its entitlement of its drawdown. How come you only get $219 million over 4 years?
I think that you lost focus on the issue now, though.
All right, so go ahead then.
Right. If I can, I'll go ahead. Because I have a couple of things which are relevant to today's discussion I wanted to say.
Let me wrap at this point. Several weeks ago, I said on the program that you govern, I quoted Mario Cuomo, who said you campaign in poetry, but govern in prose. You campaign in poetry, but govern in prose. In other words, in campaigning, a lot of lofty language, big promises are made, uplifting statements, and people, there's a good feeling about it all. But in governing in prose is the practically day-to-day implementation of your program and its impact on people's daily lives, in particular, better issues that makes a difference. I think what we're saying now is that we've gone past the euphoria and the triumphalism of the election, and now the measures being implemented are biting into people's lives.
We accept that. And,
right, so I'm just trying to put it in some sociological context and whatnot.
No, but I mean, we understand that. That's why we have in the program. Corey, if I can make a couple of very quick points.
Everybody understand it. Can I say one thing, please?
Yeah, just finish up. Peter, let him finish up, please.
Yes, please. So I'm saying that this is the point now where I agree with Dennis that I think there's general support from the society that things need to be done. But I think what is boring people is how some of the things are being done. Like I refuse to believe that with the multiplicity of advisors and special advisors and senior advisors and the economists that want, and that create the program, nobody or those economists run any program to see the impact of their proposal on the lives of those pensioners, those the people with the government, pay with the debentures and the treasury, billing treasury. No. I mean, nobody realized that at the back of these holders were people with lives and that they cut drastically from 5 or 6 or 7 thousand every 6 months to 300 or 400 is a drastic thing. I refuse the people to believe that people did not foresee that unless they were not involved in the human element, unless they were not practicing the economics that take people's lives into consideration, and they were just looking at numbers, targets, and figures, and that's why they overlooked the point that there were lives to be impacted. Now, every measure has an impact on somebody's life. So I'm yet to be convinced that, and if nobody saw it, I'm disappointed. And now the Prime Minister, thankfully, has come and said that in another week, I think she's the 8th of November, she said yesterday, she will be announcing measures to make life easier for this purpose. And at the same point, I deprecate the attempt that was made to make people believe that because you invested in these things, that you were silly, you went to risk, and you should know there's a risk. I was brought up, and I was almost a victim of that too. Almost. Because I was brought up to believe all my life I heard that government paper is safe and sound, and they invested several times on government paper with no inkling that some of this would come. So therefore, I can understand persons who put their trust in government and the reputation of government, that they would take the chance to do that. And don't forget, Barbadians have a very, Barbadians have been criticized being risk averse, and they have a very good reason.
Glenn, let me jump in here. I shared similar thoughts in the early stages. I got the opportunity to do some reading and also to answer some questions to the powers that be. And looking at the numbers, the alternatives were that we had would have to send home 10,000 people or look at the big D. Devaluation. So when you put it in the grand scheme of things and in context, it looks like a little bit better of an option than actually what is happening now. How do you respond to that?